To the 11th episode of Scared to Death. My name is Lindsay. I'm a senior psychology major.
And my name is Michelle, and I'm a senior psychology major as well.
Today we are here with Scott Harkey. He has a bachelor's in English at the University of Houston, Victoria, and a master's in IDS with a concentration in English at the University of Houston, Victoria. He works as a senior lecturer of English at UHV, and he also serves as a supervisor for Student Success Writing Center, and he's published works in cultural and literary criticism, short fiction, and poetry. Scott, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hello, everyone. Let me first say that it's a pleasure to speak with you all. I've really enjoyed your podcast, so many thanks for having me as a guest. I really appreciate it. So to introduce myself, my name is William Scott Harkey. I go by Scott, my middle name. I'm a senior lecturer of English for the University of Houston, Victoria. I can't say I specialize in anything in particular. I'm a bit of a Swiss Army teacher. I teach everything from lower division composition courses all the way to introduction to cinema and the Bible as literature and history. So basically, if there's a need for a particular course within my department and no one is available to teach it, I'll try to snag it, spend a semester or so learning the material in order to be able to teach it the following semester. So, I mean, basically my job is to read a lot and to think a lot and transmit what I've learned to others. It's why I generally love what I do. I get to teach fun subjects. My university has faith in me and my ability to teach these subjects. And I get to insert Becker and TMT ideas into the content as much as possible. Also, UHV is a smaller university, so there's a lot of close contact with students and staff and faculty. So yeah, it's just a nice place to be. And that's what I do.
Awesome. Good. And what made you want to teach at a college level, and why did you choose English specifically?
I suppose I have to begin with my time as a high school English teacher. I never thought of going into education or becoming a teacher, but I graduated with a degree in English with comparatively few career prospects around the area where I lived. I settled on English because I had a passion for writing and literature. I spent most of my teens and young adulthood playing in bands, so I always had a passion for songwriting. I also had a passion for cinema and screenwriting. So I felt that with an English degree, like an English degree would expand my kind of literary knowledge while, you know, sharpening my writing skills, so I could then go on to pursue these creative endeavors with, you know, kind of greater confidence. And so after graduation, I really wanted to go to film school, but film school is a bit of an expensive gamble. My university had a graduate program that was interdisciplinary. I thought it sounded super cool. I had more flexibility in the subjects I wanted to concentrate in. And it really was a perfect choice. I received a well-rounded education with a primary emphasis in English literature, you know, infused with other subjects, philosophy, psychology, theology, history, so on. So yeah, it was a really rewarding experience, but as all students know, education isn't cheap. I was working at an entertainment store at the time and funds for grad school were low. So my mom suggested that I go into teaching for a bit. She was a teacher at the time. My sister and brother-in-law were also in education. So it seemed like it was always in my cards. I registered for a summer alternative teaching certification program. English is what I knew best, so passing the exam wasn't a problem. And before the summer was out, I was teaching English at a high school in a small town right outside my hometown. I think there were kind of many variables that were perfectly aligned at the time. It was a small high school in a quiet town. The school valued and backed its teachers. I had a wonderful principal and many people who mentored me, who kind of endured my radical philosophies and allowed me the freedom to kind of push some heavy topics in the classroom, you know, to encourage critical thinking and so forth. So it was really a wonderful entry into the world of adulting. I was good at it and I enjoyed it tremendously. I had a lot of fun doing it, but kind of as the years went by, public education especially public education in Texas, began to change. It became more and more, I want to say oppressive, but I'll say overbearing. And more duties were being placed on teachers. That simply just made the profession too much. I still believe that teaching in public education is meaningful. It's a rewarding profession. It's just everything else that makes it not, you know, like actually teaching is great. It's everything else. So while I was in public education, I had also been adjuncting for UHV in another local community college. So I already had one leg in the college teaching pool. Eventually, I left high school teaching completely for a position as a writing coordinator and adjunct English instructor for UHV. From there, I slowly began teaching more and more classes for UHV. I loved it. I really enjoy the kind of like higher order, more theoretical discussions you can have with college students. Eventually, I moved to a full-time faculty English position, and it's been my gig ever since.
Awesome. So you teach English, but you also have a passion for studying history. Can you tell us a little about how you like got into liking history, and also how you think that studying history might provide psychological solace for the face of existential concerns?
I've always had a love for history. I guess it goes, my mom was a science teacher growing up, and she always had a passion for space and all this kind of stuff. So these kind of like these cosmic histories have always been like an interest of mine. It's been that way ever since. So sometimes I do kind of regret not studying history more, but I can do it as a passion here and there. But I think that studying history kind of alters your perception in two fundamental ways. I think like the first way I learned from Yuval Noah Harari, and he says that studying history liberates us from the past. It liberates us from the idea of determinism. So studying history reveals that the movement of history is not one based on predestination or fate or the like. History has no fixed trajectory. So the movement of history is a product of accidents and contingency, events, you know, born out of chance. And so the study of history teaches you that things could have been very different if other decisions were made, if certain geographical variables were different, if this or that occurred instead, you know, if this genetic mutation didn't occur, if an asteroid hit Earth a minute later or a minute earlier, things would have been radically different. A fascinating book to check out is A Series of Fortunate Events by the biologist Sean Carroll, just to kind of blow your mind. So in understanding that things could have been vastly different, we come to understand that, you know, things can change. There is no right way. There is no, you know, it's always been that way, so we must continue it. Things could have been different, therefore there is no reason to be enslaved by the past. Change is possible because history has no predetermined direction. And the second way studying history alters your perception is something I learned from David Christian's idea that, or his conception called big history, or what others call like deep time history. And big history basically like exposes the interconnectedness of all things. It provides us with a grand narrative of the cosmos and everything in it, which includes us. It teaches us that we all share a common origin and hence share a connection with everything. I think studying history at this scale has a potential to fill the void, you know, left from say like the decay of our other grand narratives, or at least offer some comfort as we, you know, descend further into disenchantment and disillusionment, you know, radical individual and collective narcissism, nihilism. And, you know, big history kind of gives you that overview effect that say like astronauts experience when viewing Earth from space, that kind of elicits this profound shift in perspective. You see that borders are simply agreed upon fabrications. You see how all humanity is kind of housed in a small fishbowl, you know, this marble spaceship, or, you know, a pale blue dot surfing on a sunbeam. You see things as, you know, like you're in that transparent eyeball Emerson talks about. And you might think that that this kind of cosmic perspective at such a broad scale would say like diminish the significance of humanity. But for me, at least, it does the complete opposite. It shows just how meaningful our existence in its connection with everything in the cosmos is, right? You know, we might not be the center of the universe, but that doesn't lessen our importance. There is a relatedness to all things in the cosmos. We are all family, we're not isolated islands. You know, John Donne in Devotions, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. You know, let's further extend that mankind to all things, right? We're made up of the same things, just arranged differently. And I'm thinking about Becker's notion of heroism. Perhaps this big history narrative is one that we need to construct humane, non-destructive paths to heroism and feel sincere signification. The odds of our existence are one in 400 trillion, if not more. So, you know, you're really, in a secular sense, a miracle, you know, 15 billion years in the making. So, you know, how humbling is that? You know, big history really teaches you that you should be grateful for having existed at all. And we should carry that respect, not only to every human being on Earth, but also to every plant and animal, our brothers and sisters, our cousins, if you will. And we should certainly carry that respect to the planet. So we've learned that the Earth has survived 5 mass extinctions. You know, talk of killing our planet isn't all too accurate. The planet will bounce back perfectly fine. We're killing ourselves. So, you know, we weren't born into the Earth. We emerged from the Earth, from molecules and muck, to quote Carl Sagan. And in damaging the very elements and environments that gave us life, we are, you know, basically collectively agreeing to end our species. You know, so saving ourselves should be that moral equivalent of war that William James talked about. And so I think, you know, basically studying history at this level, this having it shift your perspective like this has some pretty profound rewards.
Wow. That's great. So you said before that you try to incorporate TMT as much as you can in your lectures and everything. So how did you get into TMT and like how did you first hear about it?
This is a super fun question. Well, the theoretical underpinnings of terror management theory come from the work of Ernest Becker. So to be accurate, I guess my interest in TMT began with him. And it was by complete accident that I stumbled upon Becker. As far back as I can remember, I've had an interest in death. And my interest certainly was not like a morbid fascination or anything like that. But I was interested in it solely because I was it terrified me so much, and it still does. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that I can die at any moment without, you know, expectation or control is truly terrifying. I can't say when this terror developed, but I guess I can trace it back to being like a really sickly, accident-prone child falling out of trees and such. I was always in and out of hospitals, either for treatments for a feeble immune system or a surgery to repair broken bones, because falling out of trees or skateboards or whatever. One time I fell into an aquarium and shattered the glass. Another story. But, you know, I'm definitely certain that the awareness of this kind of ever-present possibility and inevitability of death, you know, what you guys, what TMT calls mortality salience, wasn't consciously present at this time in my life. I was far too young. But the idea that I, you know, this kind of like this thinking being, you know, was housed in this fragile body that didn't seem to be working properly. You know, that idea was like, man, this body's really screwing up. I don't get, you know, I really don't know what's going on. So, you know, I think it was from these experiences that I early on grew to realize that this body is decaying and will someday completely stop working. Nothing was able to kind of quell this terror, you know, not Epicurean logic or the kind of distal and proximal defenses that TMT addresses. As I got older, I became interested in literature and philosophy, and it seemed that all the greats of critical and creative thought shared in this terror, you know, from like Plato to Poe, all religions and so forth. You know, death appeared to be this universal problem solved only by humanly constructed illusions. I grew interested in the things they had to say about our mortality and our awareness of our inevitable fate. I was heavily influenced by the existentialists and Heidegger's notion of being unto death, you know, just like this keeping the reality of our finitude at the forefront of our thoughts in order to lead more to lead a more authentic existence, to remain mindful that death is an unavoidable certainty and one that could come at any moment. So, you know, I was looking around for what other great thinkers could teach us about mortality. And I just so happened to come across a book called The Denial of Death. And to be precise, I came across the audiobook first. And to this day, it's kind of funny. To this day, whenever I read anything relating to Becker or terror management theory, I hear Raymond Todd's voice in my head. He was the narrator of the audiobook. He has just a wonderful voice. Usually it's an older British woman. I have no idea why she's the one who normally narrates my internal voice, but whatever. So I believe this is around like 2008 or so that I discovered this book. I downloaded on a whim to give me something to listen to while I was driving or at the gym or someplace. And I was amazed, totally astonished at the kind of, you know, the compelling insight of every single sentence in that book. Every line demanded thorough meditation. And what further amazed me was just how accessible the writing was and how clearly presented were the ideas. Becker's writing is so conversational. You know, he presents his ideas clearly in the most comprehensible of ways. Around this time in my life, I was reading, or trying to read, I should say, like a lot of like structuralists and post-structuralist philosophers. I also jumped onto the Lacan bandwagon by way of Slavoj Žižek. And these thinkers require a lot of work, you know, with they're just turgid, pedantic, labyrinthian prose that are damn near impenetrable, you know, at least to my small mind. So to come across Becker's ideas relayed with such clarity was just absolutely mind-blowing. I finally discovered a thinker whose ideas kind of resonated with me, whose ideas made sense to me. I think we're all kind of looking for some like all-encompassing theory or grand narrative that just kind of pulls the curtain back to expose the answers to our most critical and existential questions, you know, especially questions regarding meaning and significance and human motivation. And Becker's work did that for me. I don't want to give listeners the impression that I think that death anxiety or death denial is, you know, the singular theory of everything, but the final conclusion that explains our individual and social activities, all of our neuroses, all that kind of stuff. You know, Becker and Wall and Piven and Yalom, all the greats stress that death is a complex, multifaceted symbol. And so it would be wrong to kind of, you know, funnel all activity down to our fear of death, you know, to equate everything to mortality salience. I think there's a great danger in being so reductive. But death anxiety is, as you all know, certainly one of other factors that serve as a catalyst of human activity that, our conscious or unconscious awareness of our mortality is a mainspring of human activity that drives, you know, a considerable portion of our behavior. Mm-hmm. So to get back, I'm jamming this audiobook and I had to stop it and grab a copy of the text. It was too good, in order to better concentrate on it. And I don't know how many times I've read The Denial of Death and Becker's other works for that matter, but I still find myself pausing at a sentence or a paragraph to just fully marinate on these ideas. Becker's writing is almost too much, you know, too overwhelming, too many epiphanies. I'm kind of reminded of what Cornel West said about reading Moby Dick. You know, at times you have to like throw the book against the wall. you have to go sit on the toilet for a bit. You know, you got to go get some water. It's just too much. It's too much life in it. So, you know, it was through Becker's Denial of Death that I began searching out other scholars who were influenced by his ideas, as well as scholars who influenced Becker. You know, the reference pages are there for a reason, to take you back to the sources. So I began reading like Rank and Kierkegaard and Walls and Brown. I got really into Goffman and Lifton. Although Amazon gets a lot of criticism and much is warranted, you know, it was kind of through their algorithmic suggestions that I learned of folks like Piven and Yalom and Lechte. Dan Lechte's book, Transference and Transcendence, is such a wonderful introduction to Becker's idea. I highly recommend that book. But any basic internet search of Ernest Becker will quickly bring you to the man, Sheldon Solomon, perhaps the most known and eccentric Becker scholar. And it was through him and his colleagues, Jeff Greenberg and Tom Kaczynski, that I learned about terror management. And through their work, you know, it all comes together beautifully. You know, we find definitive conclusions to Becker's theories, you know, legitimating what before had been viewed with, you know, kind of skepticism and even condemnation. This substantiated support that TMT brought to Becker's theory is totally undeniable. And I was hooked, you know. I spent most of my time listening to Sheldon's talks. Just like Becker, Sheldon conveys these, you know, weighty ideas with clarity and humor, and delivered in such a unique way, right? Like you think you're listening to some pot smoking guru from the 70s. It's totally embarrassing to admit like how much of a like fan nerd I was, how obsessed I was with TMT and Becker and so forth. But everything I could find on YouTube at the time, again, this was like 2008 or 2009, whatever. Everything I could find on YouTube, I ended up converting them to audio files so I could jam them in the car. And I still have them to this day. There's like 60 or 70 files on my phone. I still listen to it. And I can't forget the documentary Flight from Death either. I love seeing, you know, footage of many of the classic TMT experiments. And from there, the Becker-inspired book collection grew from Sheldon et al.'s Wake of 9/11 to Lindsay's book, Denying Death, and it continues to grow. And I think these are so long-winded, I'm sorry, but I love talking about these ideas. They're so much fun. But, you know, how do I relate to the theory? I certainly do. The TMT provides me with a vocabulary and a lens through which I can articulate and interpret human interactions and behavior. And I think we should all relate to the theory, you know, considering how it has demonstrated the influence mortality salience has on policymaking, on judicial deliberations, voting, and other decisions, you know, of great magnitude. I think TMT and existential social psychology offer appealing explanations into many of the wild and hyper-emotional behaviors we've observed in the past, you know, well, especially the past 2 years with the pandemic, but, you know, the six years, even last, you know, 5 decades for that matter. TMT has found fascinating answers to the questions of why sane people are acting in totally insane ways. What's driving people to react with such malicious aggression, right? You know, from prejudice against foreigners to a vitriolic stance on mask wearing. TMT has shown us that the psychological agitation engendered by our economic woes, you know, the pandemic, the fear of the other, and now we're faced once again with the fear of nuclear war, of job security, technical revolution, deteriorating traditional meta narratives of death in its symbolic and literal sense. You know, TMT has shown us that much of this unhinged behavior we see is a product of just humanity tenaciously clinging to symbols and shared illusions for psychological comfort, you know, clinging to anything to ease this agitation and offer signification and meaning in a precarious and unpredictable world bottled in an indifferent universe. Problems at all level of extreme, they're just arising, you know, further as we come in contact with others who don't share these same symbols and illusions. And it's only being exacerbated as we become more and more globalized and connected through technology. So yeah, TMT rocks, I gotta say.
And tell how passionate you are about it. It's awesome.
Totally.
um, So as we talked about a little, that you like to incorporate like terror management theory in your classes, how exactly do you incorporate and how would you say that your like students react to it?
Let's see, how do I incorporate it into my classes? I guess the class where Becker and TMT ideas show up the most, I suppose would be in my Bible as literature class. You know, it's obvious that a book that has constructed the worldviews of so many for so long would thoroughly articulate ideas of, you know, death anxiety, death denial, you know, literal symbolic immortality, value in a meaningful world, you know, creature anxiety, anxiety over the body and the bodily functions for sure, right? So, you know, almost every book in the Bible, this anthology collection of book addresses these kind of ideas in some capacity. You know, look at the emphasis on separation and categorization, you know, the attire that we read about in the priestly source, you know, designation through symbols of prestige and rank and so on. The importance of, my students always crack up about how the emphasis in covering your private parts, you know, if you show a butt crack, I'm gonna kill you, you know, like all that kind of stuff, you know, concealing the fact that we're creatures of the earth, you know, concealing that we're angels, but we have these anuses and oh my gosh, these anuses routinely expel reminders of our creatureliness. So, you know, there's this emphasis on distancing ourselves from our corporeal reality, our physical bodies, and so on. So, you know, the book emphasized, you know, you might be angelic and made in God's image, but we need to conceal these reminders that you are angelic and subject to nature, and therefore subject to death and biological determinism. So, you know, also look at the importance of progeny. In Lifton's work, he calls this biological symbolic immortality. So living on through your offspring, right? Lineage, passing from fathers to sons was vital to the shared identity of the ancient Hebrews on up to the time of Jesus. You know, look at the often skipped genealogical list in Matthew and Luke, right? We also see Lifton's notion of creative symbolic immortality through great works, buildings, statues, monuments, temples, and the like. I remember in 2 Samuel, Absalom, you know, he kind of knew his life was at risk. He had no sons to carry on his legacy. So what does he do? He erects a monument to himself in the king's valleys, you know, for pretty much the same reason as we read in Gilgamesh, right? Establishing this wall. If I'm to die, at least a symbolic representation of me will live on past my death and immortalize me. You know, I've left this work that will transcend this earthly condition, you know, this testament to my heroic immortality. It's immortality by proxy, right? We also see in most all of the Bible's books, the narratives that offer the people of Israel, the ancient Hebrews, signification in a meaningful world. You know, you are the chosen people. You know, how about that for an esteem booster? My gosh, the creator of the universe, you know, says this, I'm chosen. Oh man, this is great. So, you know, we see this, the concept also of literal immortality within the later books of the Bible. This idea is actually absent in the earlier books. We see symbolic purging of guilt through scapegoating, you know, Durkheimian, Girardian cohesion produced in scapegoating and rituals. But most importantly, notably, we see the most brilliant move on the part of the ancient Hebrews in their rejection of idols, idolatry, and in the conception of God as a transcendent abstract agent. This is brilliant. You know, if your God is intangible, untouchable by time, omniscient, omnipresent, you know, existing beyond anything corporeal, you can't lose, right? Like, God as a transcendent becomes an indestructible transference object that the ancient Hebrews could continually draw psychological strength from without fear that it would show, you know, its clay feet, to use Becker's metaphor. You know, you can't turn the transcendent, the transient into the transcendent, or the earthly into the ethereal, or the finite into the infinite. You know, our worldly transference objects are always at the mercy of entropy, of corrosion, of damage, and age and decay and weathering and so forth, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, when your expensive sports car that functions as an extension of your symbolic self, and as a resource of your sense of self-value and esteem gets scratched, you too get scratched, right? Becker talks about this in The Birth and Death of Meaning. So, you know, when you use your body as a transference object and it begins to decay or show its age or slows down, your mortality stares at you every time you look in the mirror, right? Just like assaulting you with unfiltered death anxiety. You know, this is why the cosmetic industry is so profitable. This is why I really can't stand those Facebook memory photos either. It's just like my decay is just staring at me, right? And this is kind of why all photography is a form of memento mori. Roland Barthes talks about this. I believe Sontag as well. So, you know, but not the God of the ancient Hebrews, right? Or in the later Christians, you know, as an abstract entity, God exists always and forever as a pristine source of continual strength. You know, this idea was quite unique for the time. Most other Middle and Near Eastern belief systems, you know, they had like tangible representations for their deities, you know, from human beings to Asherah poles, totems, idols, grand temples, all that kind of stuff, right? These tangible representations were prone to deterioration and destruction of all things, you know, just as all things corporeal, earthly, and finite are. Think of ancient Mesopotamian warfare. How did you achieve total victory? You stole the loser's gods. You know, you stole their idols. You smashed them. You took them back to your temple or whatever. But, you know, once the God of the ancient Hebrews kind of left the presence of the ark, he was untouchable, you know, a total victor, you know, couldn't smash or seal him or anything like that. There's this great passage from Genesis that I always crack up when I'm reading. Laban discovers that Rachel has stolen his gods, and he's just super pissed off. He's just running around like, you stole my gods and all this kind of stuff. And she's like sitting on him, and she like feigns that she's menstruating so he couldn't, you know, touch her or whatever, and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, and lastly, you know, because again, I'm just being long-winded. I'm sorry. I just love these ideas so much. Like, definitely the Bible deals with worldview conflicts. You know, these worldview conflicts are amplified to cosmic magnitude. You know, look at Numbers, look at Joshua, Judges, Kings, all this kind of stuff. Becker in Escape from Evil says that, you know, all wars are holy wars. All wars are holy and that they are tests of divine favor. If we win, it means our God, our way of life, our people, our culture, our ideologies are superior to yours, and our victory proves it, right? Like, we are cosmically legitimated. So, you know, we saw this in ancient Mesopotamia, where warfare wasn't waged by people per se, it was waged by the gods, and gods wanted it, and warfare was just the gods battling it out for superiority, and humans were their pawns, right? My God wants to fight your God, and the stakes are our city-states. We see this played out in literal form in these warring books of the Bible. You know, it's trial by ordeal at a mass scale. Also, you have to acknowledge that these books were produced in a time of immense collective anxiety. You know, the ancient Hebrews were first captive in a foreign land under the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, then under Hellenization, then under the Romans. The Bible is probably where it shows up most. In cinema and literature courses, TMT and Becker ideas are, you know, kind of easily casually inserted here and there. You can kind of see, you see story characters, each with their own worldviews, creating conflict. And the engine of engaging stories is conflict, you know, notably through these clashing of worldviews. So every character that comes on a scene has their own worldview, sees reality through their own tunnel, you know, their own reality tunnel, and their ideologies clash with other characters. So bringing TMT and Becker theories into this class comes easily. We actually, in my cinema class, we just recently watched and discussed Children of Men, phenomenal film. If you guys haven't seen it, definitely watch it. And I had a blast addressing, you know, death anxiety brought on by inevitable human extinction and the kind of tightening of worldviews prompted by this anxiety. You know, our worldviews are the fountain from which we draw our sense of value. They provide us with human constructed meaningful answers to existential questions. They tell us we are valuable participants in a meaningful world. So these apocalyptic films do well in illustrating how we find refuge in the cultural worldviews that give us significance. You know, they tell us that we are unique and special individuals, and that some literal or symbolic trace of us will stain history and remain after our death. The fictitious nature of human meaning systems and the absurdity of the pageants of heroism within symbolic culture. You know, the symbolic is no match against physical nature. And we see this in most apocalyptic films. The entire human race is unable to repress the ultimate terror of death. And due to this inability, society begins to fragment. You know, these films depict the way people react in both positive and negative ways when all hope is lost and death is imminent and mortality, you know, remains salient. So, I guess inserting Becker and TNT ideas is a little more difficult in my other classes. My lower level, my lower division comp classes, the students work on researching and writing on a particular cause or campaign for which they aggravate. So sometimes I can address Becker's thoughts on, say, like the urge to merge within collective endeavors, political campaigns and groups of all kinds, you know, the kind of safe heroics of the crowd. But for the most part, I kind of shy away from talking about things like that in those classes. Rock and roll.
That's You're very passionate and we love that, honestly. Well, now kind of changing a little bit the topic, but I still might relate to TMT. We saw that you are a world traveler. I personally have lived in 4 different countries. I was born in Venezuela. I moved to Chile, then to Spain, and now I'm in the United States. And I have traveled around all South America, part of Europe, part of Central America. So, and I know Lindsay also has traveled a lot too. So we just wanted to know more about like, how these experiences have impacted you and like what were your favorite ones, like some memory that you have that you would like to share with us.
Oh man, I love this question. This is a good question. I love traveling. So my favorite places, that's really difficult to answer. Every place has its own magic, right? I don't know. I mean, Scottish Highlands, the Alps around Austria. I mean, you know, every place does have its magic. But I think the two places that have left the greatest impact on me are China and Catalonia. I think that many Americans have kind of grown up hearing and internalizing a particular narrative, you know, regarding China and the Chinese people. One that's severely biased and severely overgeneralized. You know, additionally, the Chinese people are in no way a reflection of their government. And this applies to every country, right? You know, I think this is one of the most educational facets of traveling. Like, you learn that people are people. People are not their governments. People don't want war. Their governments do. People simply want to laugh and eat good food and have friends and all that kind of stuff, right? And the Chinese people are no different. You know, they were gracious and humble and kind-hearted. They were helpful and polite, proud of their past, and very appreciative that travelers want to experience their country. So yeah, China for one. Oh man, Catalonia. I don't know what to say. I met so many wonderful people who just exemplify Camus' notion of just living to the point of tears, right? Like, it seemed like every day was a celebration of life. In Catalonia, I don't know, you just slow down, you meditate on the present, you bask in small pleasures. It was China and Catalonia that left the most vivid and happy memories on me. But yeah, like I said, every place has its magic. And it seems like You know, it seems like every place I visited, I immediately wanted to move to, right? Any traveler experiences that, you know, even in the States or whatever, you know, you go to New York, like, oh yeah, I could live here. I don't know, probably not. Like, I like my grocery store, like over there, not like below me. But I know I'm seeing these places as an outsider. So my perception of these places is from the point of view of a traveler, not a local. Traveling is my bliss. It really is. I guess I have that everlasting itch that Melville talks about. It's kind of a way for me to step off that hedonic hamster wheel and really experience life, you know, not the usual automatic, scripted, comfortable routine we normally find ourselves in. When you travel, you know, you're like thrown into the present. I love the excitement that comes with novelty, newness, the unfamiliarity of the surroundings, the people, the culture, the beliefs, and especially I'm a huge foodie. I'm a food junkie. Like, mm-hmm. I love the food. I love experiencing new types of food. And in a good and interesting way, you know, things are strange, right? Things are weird. Things are different. Things are shocking. Oh my gosh, have you ever seen the toilets in France? What's that all about? Like, so weird. Like, you know, so like traveling is a cheat meal for the soul, right? You're like mainlining an adventure. So, you know, I mean, basically if all goes well, you only have 4,000 weeks of life. So, you know, you better make the best of it by, you know, setting aside lobotomizing yourself, binge watching shows, you know, living out secondhand experiences through screens, and go have an adventure, right? Traveling is that adventure, you know? Traveling is also a learning experience. You not only learn about how similar we all are, but you also learn about yourself, you know, your values, how you view humanity. It's wonderful. But to maybe move into Becker and TMT, you know, there's also a sadness in knowing how little of the world you'll actually experience. And, you know, for a hypersensitive person like myself, you know, when I travel, I sometimes feel like Rilke, you know, on his famous walk with Freud, you know, that this is all going to end. So, you know, I guess like being thrown into the present from the automatic, you know, kind of makes me reflect more on just the transience of everything. You know, when you travel, you encounter so many wonderful individuals along your journey, along your adventure, you know, but as a traveler, you're just kind of passing through, you know, for like a brief moment, you know, rubbing elbows with other people passing through life, you know, all fellow passengers to the grave, like Dickens said. And you kind of realize that, like, my God, man, we really all are in the same existential predicament. You know, we all suffer from the same fate. You know, there's kind of a sadness in knowing that everyone you meet, everyone you connect with, or, you know, simply exist with in the same place, there's kind of a sadness in knowing that this will all that this will be the one and only time you'll be together, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a fact of all of our travels, right? Going to distant countries, you know, overseas or whatever, to going to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this realization underscores the precariousness of life and the kind of sacredness of life. You know, you and everyone you meet on your travels will someday, you know, breathe for the final time, and that's it. You know, we're all just creatures for a day, like Marcus Aurelius said. You know, how right was he? This realization kind of renders everything precious and valuable and worthy of care. You know, nothing is just a means. You kind of see, to be thrown in the present in your travels, you begin to kind of see everything as finite, you know, here for a moment and gone forever. It makes you want to, love a little deeper and hold on a little longer, you know, help a little more, care a little more, you know, call your mom more, you know, connect with others more. I think keeping this in mind will help us, you know, maybe be a little kinder and a little more understanding and less apt to go to war. I'll end out like the Stoics and existentialists and sages of all kind, a teacher in Ecclesiastes, Nietzsche, you know, they all teach us the importance in understanding that everything ends, that life is an emergency. So it's, you know, it's best not to sweat the trivial, right? Go have adventures, go on your travels, you know, seek life experiences, crave life, crave quality over quantity, fully exhaust life, and leave nothing for death to take when your time comes, right? I think that's good stuff. That's really good.
That's awesome. Really awesome ideas that you have. I really liked listening. For joining us, and thank you to all our listeners for tuning in, and tune back in for a couple weeks for the next episode.